This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Return of the Native by Thomas Hardy. Book 6, After Courses. 3. The Serious Discourse of Klim with His Cousin. Throughout this period, Yeobright had more or less pondered on his duty to his cousin Thomasin. He could not help feeling that it would be a pitiful waste of sweet material if the tender-natured thing should be doomed from this early stage of her life onwards to dribble away her winsome qualities on lonely gorse and fern. But he felt this as an economist merely, and not as a lover. His passion for Eustacia had been a sort of conserve of his whole life, and he had nothing more of that supreme quality left to bestow. So far, the obvious thing was not to entertain any idea of marriage with Thomasin, even to oblige her. But this was not all. Years ago, there had been in his mother's mind a great fancy about Thomasin and himself. It had not positively amounted to a desire, but it had always been a favourite dream. That they should be man and wife in good time, if the happiness of neither were endangered thereby, was the fancy in question. So that what course save one was there now left for any son who reverenced his mother's memory as Yeobright did? It is an unfortunate fact that any particular whim of parents, which might have been dispersed by half an hour's conversation during their lives, becomes sublimated by their deaths into a fiat the most absolute, with such results to conscientious children as those parents, had they lived, would have been the first to decry. Had only Yeobright's own future been involved, he would have proposed to Thomasin with a ready heart. He had nothing to lose by carrying out a dead mother's hope. But he dreaded to contemplate Thomasin wedded to the mere corpse of a lover that he now felt himself to be. He had but three activities alive in him. One was his almost daily walk to the little graveyard wherein his mother lay. Another, his just as frequent visits by night to the more distant enclosure which numbered his Eustacia among its dead. The third was self-preparation for a vocation which alone seemed likely to satisfy his cravings, that of an itinerant preacher of the 11th commandment. It was difficult to believe that Thomasin would be cheered by a husband with such tendencies as these. Yet he resolved to ask her and let her decide for herself. It was even with a pleasant sense of doing his duty that he went downstairs to her one evening for this purpose, when the sun was printing on the valley the same long shadow of the housetop that he had seen lying there times out of number while his mother lived. Thomasin was not in her room, and he found her in the front garden. "I've long been wanting, Thomasin," he began, "to say something about a matter that concerns both our futures." "And you are going to say it now?" she remarked quickly, colouring as she met his gaze. "Do stop a minute, Klim, and let me speak first, for, oddly enough, I have been wanting to say something to you."
"Oh, by all means, say on, Tamsy."
"I suppose nobody can overhear us," she went on, casting her eyes around and lowering her voice. "Well, first you will promise me this, that you won't be angry and call me anything harsh if you disagree with what I propose."
Yeobright promised, and she continued.
"What I want is your advice. For you are my relation, I mean sort of guardian to me, aren't you, Klim?"
"Well, yes, I suppose I am a sort of guardian,"
In fact, I am, of course, he said, altogether perplexed as to her drift. I'm thinking of marrying, she then observed, blandly. But I shall not marry unless you assure me that you approve of such a step. Why don't you speak?
I was taken rather by surprise. But nevertheless, I'm very glad to hear such news. I shall approve, of course, dear Tamsie.
Who can it be? I'm quite at a loss to guess.
Oh, no, I'm not. 'Tis the old doctor. Not that I meant to call him old, for he's not very old after all.
Ah, I noticed when he attended you last time.
No, no, she said hastily.
'Tis Mr. Venn.
Klim's face suddenly became grave.
There, now, you don't like him, and I wish I hadn't mentioned him, she exclaimed almost petulantly. And I shouldn't have done it either, only he keeps on bothering me so, till I don't know what to do.
Klim looked at the heath. I like Venn well enough, he answered at last. He's a very honest, and at the same time, astute man. He is clever, too, as is proved by his having got you to favour him.
But really, Thompson, he's not quite gentleman enough for me. That is just what I feel. I'm sorry now that I asked you, and I won't think any more of him. At the same time, I must marry him if I marry anybody, that I will say.
I don't see that, said Klim, carefully concealing every clue to his own interrupted intention, which she plainly had not guessed. You might marry a professional man or somebody of that sort by going into the town to live and forming acquaintances there.
Oh, I'm not fit for town life, so very rural and silly as I always have been. Do you not yourself notice my countrified ways?
Well, when I came home from Paris I did a little. But I don't know.
That's because you've got countrified too. Oh, I couldn't live in a street for the world. Egdon's a ridiculous old place, but I have got used to it, and I couldn't be happy anywhere else at all.
Neither could I, said Klim.
Then how could you say that I should marry some town man? I'm sure, say what you will, that I must marry Diggory, if I marry at all. He has been kinder to me than anybody else, and has helped me in many ways that I don't know of.
Thomasin almost pouted now. Yes, he has, said Klim in a neutral tone. Well, I wish with all my heart that I could say, marry him. But I cannot forget what my mother thought on that matter, and it goes rather against me not to respect her opinion. There is too much reason why we should do the little we can to respect it now.
Very well, then, sighed Thomasin. I will say no more.
But you're not bound to obey my wishes. I merely say what I think.
Oh, no, I don't want to be rebellious in that way, she said sadly. I've no business to think of him. I ought to have thought of my family. What dreadfully bad impulses there are in me.
Her lip trembled and she turned away to hide a tear. Klim, though vexed at what seemed her unaccountable taste, was in a measure relieved to find that at any rate the marriage question in relation to himself was shelved. Through several succeeding days he saw her at different times from the window of his room, moping disconsolately about the garden. He was half angry with her for choosing Venn. Then he was grieved at having put himself in the way of Venn's happiness, who was, after all, as honest and persevering a young fellow as any on Egdon, since he had turned over a new leaf. In short, Klim did not know what to do. When next they met, she said abruptly,
"He's much more respectable now than he was then."
"Who?" Oh, yes, Diggory Venn.
Aunt only objected because he was a Reddleman. Well, Thomasin, perhaps I don't know all the particulars of my mother's wish. So you had better use your own discretion. You will always feel that I slighted your mother's memory. No, I will not. I shall think you are convinced that had she seen Diggory in his present position, she would have considered him a fitting husband for you. Now, that's my real feeling. Don't consult me any more, but do as you like, Thomasin. I shall be content. It is to be supposed that Thomasin was convinced, for a few days after this, when Clym strayed into a part of the heath that he had not lately visited, Humphrey, who was at work there, said to him, "I'm glad to see that Mrs. Wildeve and Van have made it up again, seemingly." "Have they?" said Clym abstractedly. "Yes, and he do contrive to stumble upon her whenever she walks out on fine days with the child. But, Mr. Yeobright, I can't help feeling that your cousin ought to have married you. 'Tis a pity to make two chimney corners where there need be only one. You could get her away from him now, 'tis my belief, if you were only to set about it." How can I have the conscience to marry after having driven two women to their deaths? Don't think such a thing, Humphrey. After my experience, I should consider it too much of a burlesque to go to church and take a wife. In the words of Job, "I have made a covenant with mine eyes. Why then should I think upon a maid?" "No, Mr. Clym, don't fancy that about driving two women to their deaths. You shouldn't say it." "Well, we'll leave that out," said Yeobright. "But anyhow, God has set a mark upon me, which wouldn't look well in a love-making scene. I have two ideas in my head and no others. I'm going to keep a night school, and I'm going to turn preacher. What have you got to say to that, Humphrey?"
"I'll come and hear ye with all my heart." "Thanks. 'Tis all I wish."
As Clym descended into the valley, Thomasin came down by the upper path, and met him at the gate.
"What do you think I have to tell you, Clym?" she said, looking archly over her shoulder at him.
"I can guess," he replied. She scrutinized his face.
"Yes, you guess right. It's going to be, after all. He thinks I may as well make up my mind, and I have got to think so, too. It's to be on the 25th of next month, if you don't object."
"Do what you think right, dear. I am only too glad that you see your way clear to happiness again. My sex owes you every amends for the treatment you received in days gone by." End of chapter 3. But the author made a note. The writer may state here that the original conception of the story did not design a marriage between Thomasin and Venn. He was to have retained his isolated and weird character to the last, and to have disappeared mysteriously from the heath, nobody knowing whither, Thomasin remaining a widow. But certain circumstances of serial publication led to a change of intent. Readers can therefore choose between the endings, and those with an austere artistic code can assume the more consistent conclusion to be the true one. End of chapter 3, author's note.